February the 27th. The last lesson we have in the month. We last time ended up just about at chapter 9 of Nehemiah. Now suppose we anticipate just a little bit here as we start into Nehemiah. And instead of starting there with chapter 9, let's just turn over for a moment to chapter 11. I want you to notice something. And I might forget it if we'll wait until I get through that time. Just ran across this the other day. It's a little interesting item. I might help you with the prophecies. But you probably remember, those of you who've seen the chart on the studies in Daniel 9, 24, and 5, the two prophecies concerning the first and second advents of Christ, that the 70 weeks in Daniel 9, 24 is determined upon the people and the holy city. Now notice that, holy city. As far as time is concerned, if we take up a chronological table in the Bible and so on, this is the first time that it is mentioned as a holy city, Jerusalem. That is as far as time is concerned. But Nehemiah here is writing a few years later. And in chapter 11 in Nehemiah, we read, "And the rulers of the people dwelt at Jerusalem. The rest of the people also cast lots to bring out of 10 to dwell in Jerusalem, the holy city, and 9 parts to dwell in other cities." There, it finally is called the holy city then in history. And this is when they go back and rebuild the city and the temple and start their worship again, and even obeying the law concerning the feasts, and especially the Feast of Tabernacles. Now that is a little point that can be noted. You probably are aware of the fact that most people think of the Holy City as being the New Jerusalem. Now you can look that up and see what you find on that. Well, now let's go back to chapter 9. I just wanted to throw that in here so you would have something to chew on for a while and to think about. Now, we just ended up chapter 8, and there we find that they built their little booths, as they were supposed to do in the law, on the housetops, in the street, and out in the hills, and everywhere where they could, and kept the Feast of Tabernacles for 8 days. Says they kept the feast 7 days, and on the eighth was a solemn assembly, almost like the high Sabbath of the Passover feast, except that it came a little earlier in the week. Now remember that we are here talking about a period about a year after the dedication of the temple. Now the dedication of the temple was in 405 B.C. And the events we're talking about here happened in the next year, 404 B.C. And this month in the year where the Feast of Tabernacles come was called Tishri, the seventh month. So in chapter 9 we read, "Now in the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel were assembled with fasting and with sackcloth and earth upon them." Now, when people mourn, when they want to confess their sins and so on, this was the custom among those people. 3 things. They would fast, not eat very much, or hardly at all. And with sackcloth, or sackcloth, for clothing, which was very rough. I don't know how it's like our gunny sacks we have now or not. It'd be pretty rough if it were. And earth upon them. Usually putting a handful of dirt on top of the head or something like that and on their shoulders, showing their humility. And the seed of Israel, that is, the true Israelites, separated themselves from all strangers, foreigners, Gentiles, and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. Now, I think you've noticed when we studied in Daniel, when he made his prayer, he went back and confessed all the sins of Israel and so on, as if he were also guilty. And he was associated or identified with them in that. And so here the people identify themselves with their fathers who had so grievously sinned and been punished so many times and so on. And so they are really asking for the forgiveness of the sins of their fathers as well as their own. And they stood up in their place and read in the book of the law of the Lord their God, 1/4 part of the day, about 3 hours. Another 1/4 part, 3 hours, they confessed and worshiped the Lord their God. Notice the order that they read the word first. Read out of that. And then they confessed and worshiped the Lord their God. Now, this is a pretty good order to follow even yet today. Read the Word and let God talk to us, and then we can talk to God. We have something to talk about then. But let God speak first. Read His Word. Let Him have first place. And all too often, we find if we don't have this prelude of reading the Word or meditating on it, having it in our mind, that we don't pray so easily. Don't have much to pray about, I guess, talk to God about. Personal prayer is talking with God. The common idea of prayer today, I guess, is just all gimme. And maybe if we would look at some of the examples we have in the Bible about prayer and the like, we might get some good ideas. We have some folks mentioned here. Then stood upon the stairs the Levites, Jeshua, Bani, Kadmiel, Shebaniah, Bunny, Sherebiah, Bani, and Shinani, and cried with a loud voice unto the Lord their God. Then the Levites, Jeshua, and Kadmiel, Bani, Hashbaniah, Sherebiah, Hodijah, Shebaniah, and Pethahiah said, "Stand up and bless the Lord your God forever and ever, and blessed be thy glorious name, which is exalted above all blessing and praise." And they begin to get into a pretty high degree here of their praise and so on, because they are using an expression in this next verse that you don't find very often in the Old Testament. In fact, about 10 times is about the limit in the Old Testament. Now note, "Thou, even thou, art Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven and the heaven of heavens." The heaven of heavens. Now there are some who do not see the significance of this, and so they have made this to be an apposition. The heavens, yea, the heaven of heavens. But are they two? The heaven which is above us, the firmament, and then the heaven of heavens which is out beyond the universe, the heavenly places we have in Ephesians, and Colossians, and the holiest of all is called in Hebrews, the highest heaven, and the Lord passed through the heavens to go to this heaven. We find that in Hebrews. Now we find this mentioned in Deuteronomy 10:14, if I remember right, the first time, heaven of heavens. Now the word made here is not translated create. Now made usually means to put into position or into use or something of that kind. We find the word made and the word create both in Genesis 1:1, and it's a good idea to see the difference. At any rate, they say this, "Thou, even thou, art Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven the heaven of heavens, and all their host, the earth, and all things that are therein, the seas, and all that is therein, and thou preservest them all, and the host of heaven worshipeth thee. Now the host of heaven is not the heaven of heavens, the host of heaven worshipeth thee. Now the host of heaven can mean two different things. Sometimes the host of heaven is spoken of as the stars. And so the idolaters began to worship the host of heaven, the stars. But the host of heaven also refers to angels. And of course, here it is angels because they worship the Most High God. So again, you have to go by context in getting the actual meaning of a word. Thou art the Lord, the God, who didst choose Abram, and broughtest him forth out of Ur of the Chaldees, and gavest him the name of Abraham. Going right back to the beginnings of the history of Israel, beginning with Abraham. Going back there and reciting the things that God has done and the things that they have done. And notice the record we have concerning Abraham. And foundest his heart faithful before thee, and madest a covenant with him to give the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Jebusites, and the Girgashites, to give it, I say, to his seed, and hast performed thy word, for thou art righteous. Well, if God is righteous, he would perform his words. He would keep his promise, wouldn't he? And he did. He gave this land to Israel. Now, they didn't take all of it that he gave to them. That's the other side of the story. But he gave it to them. And if we don't take all that God has given to us, that's our own fault. That's our own loss. And he goes on to say, and did see the affliction of our fathers in Egypt, and heardest their cry by the Red Sea. Now, here's two different things here in this one verse. Their affliction when they were slaves, and they were whipped by cruel taskmasters, and they had more work to do than they could really do. And the Egyptians tried to work them and wear them down and decrease their number because they were scared because these Israelites were multiplying so fast and there were so many of them that they might turn on the Egyptians someday and then what would happen. So they tried every way to bring them down, and of course everything that they did only worked the other way. And then the next step, after the Passover in Egypt and they were herded down there by the Red Sea, and a mountain on one side and the sea on the other, and the Egyptian army coming behind, there was no escape. But it says, and heardest their cry by the Red Sea. He heard it. And of course the sea opened up and they went through. And showed us signs and wonders upon Pharaoh, and all his servants, and all the people of his land. Well, think of the 10 plagues, for instance, that came upon Egypt. Great signs and wonders that time, so people could see and could believe. For thou knewest that they dealt proudly against them. Now, I'm not too sure about this. I have found some notes on this verse, not in here particularly, in my companion Bible. However, I think we can leave it just as it stands. The Egyptians did deal proudly against Israel. That's true. There might be more to it than that. So didst thou get thee a name, as it is this day. They got a name among the heathen peoples. They heard about this. There wasn't a country at that time that was within the trading circles of the Phoenicians and others with what got to hear about this thing that happened down at the Red Sea and how Pharaoh and his army were drowned. And of course, before that, the plagues upon Egypt and judgments and so on. And so it did give the living God a name. And here in speaking this, in 404 B.C., even to this day, or as it is this day, they still had a name because God still had a name among the heathen because of what he had done. And thou didst divide the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on the dry land. They didn't wade through mud either, and that's an awfully muddy place if we know where it is, mire and so on, the bottom of it. Now, if you will read the account in Exodus and a song of Miriam, you will notice that she didn't say dry ground. She spoke of the waters, however, and that they were congealed. Well, now maybe that begins to put the picture together a little bit. If the waters are congealed, then probably the mud was too. And they passed over without getting their feet wet or even muddy. Congealed water. Well, you know what that is. We used to have ice boxes we put congealed water in, you know. And we've had quite a bit of that congealed water this winter, too. Well, there it is. A wonderful miracle. The Red Sea, one of the warmest bodies of water on the face of the earth. And a blast from heaven would freeze it so that Israel could go across dry shod, part the waters, and they go across on this frozen mud, dry shod. But you see, by the time the Egyptians got onto it with their chariots and their horses, why, the freezing was about over. And the chariots broke through the crust and broke the wheels off and the horses mired down. And the people got mixed up, and while they were in that awful mix-up, the waters came together again and drowned the whole bunch. And they were gone, for God told them to Israel that they'd never see them again. Well, thou didst divide the sea before them so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land, never got their feet wet. And their persecutors thou threwest into the deeps as a stone into the mighty waters. That's rather poetical, isn't it? Well, the Hebrew language is poetic, and we find a lot of poetic pictures given to us in the Old Testament. Moreover, thou leddest them in the day by a cloudy pillar, and in the night by a pillar of fire, to give them light in the way wherein they should go. And so they had a miraculous leading. But all people might know about that too. Thou camest down also upon Mount Sinai, and spakest with them from heaven, and gavest them right judgments, and true laws, good statutes, and commandments. There's your Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and of course all the rules and regulations that went along with it. The Decalogue was only the backbone of it, and of course we have the explanations of how to carry out these laws, as well as the rituals and ordinances which they were to perform in their religious ceremonies. Remember that we have a peculiar position here with Israel and with God. We don't have anything like it today. There's never been anything like it before. Israel were under the rule of their God. He made the laws. There was no separation at that time of what we call church and state. In fact, it's called a theocracy. That is God ruling. Now that was a condition Israel under, and it's an ideal condition. Now of course that was spoiled to some extent when they got kings, but still those kings were subject to the law same as anybody else. Ordinarily, in heathen countries, a king was above the law. He could about do as he pleased. And, of course, there are rulers in all countries that get it into their heads sometimes that they're above the law and they can do as they please. And then we have to deal with rulers. So that's not uncommon. So if we keep in mind that here Israel is a theocracy, a government from the God of heaven, and any leaders, rulers, and so on that they had were subject to that the same as the poorest man in all Israel. Now, if you will read the prophecies and see how the prophets talk to some of the kings about these things, you'll begin to realize the why. Well, God spoke from heaven, and of course, when it began to thunder and lightning and make a lot of noise and so on, why, they finally got scared and they said to Moses, "You go talk to God and tell us what he has to say. We're afraid to hear." They're afraid they'd die. Well, I didn't finish the sentence. Verse 14. As well as giving them true law, good statute, commandments, and the right judgments, made known unto them thy holy Sabbath. The holy Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, they were told. Of course, now, a lot of people today will keep what they think is a Sabbath, and they keep it holy. W-H-O-L-L-Y to themselves. Not H-O-L-Y. And commandest them precepts, statutes, and laws by the hand of Moses, thy servant. I remember at this Ten Commandments was a covenant. And the covenant was between two parties. And God had said what he would do if they would do what he asked them to do in this covenant. And they kept it 39 days and made the golden calf. So then it became law, absolute. This do and live. And anybody who sinned against the law, death was the penalty. Now those laws are righteous. There wasn't a lawyer at the time in Israel or anywhere else who could find fault with the law that God gave to Israel. They were holy and good. And Paul even is telling that in his epistle to the Romans, that the law was holy and just and good. Well, why did it fail? Well, for the simple reason that the flesh is weak and is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. That was where the rub came. Dealing with flesh, these folks had so much carnal nature in them that it was awfully hard for them to keep God's law. And gave us them bread from heaven. And over in John's Gospel, you read these words, "I am the bread from heaven." This was prefiguring Christ, who is the true bread from heaven. They were given manna. Oh, and we hear and read a great deal about how the people try to explain that away, that it was something else and so on. I just heard just recently that it was the little drops that fell off of the tamarisk tree, I believe it was, or something like that, a tamarisk, and fell on the ground and so on. But you know, the funny part of it is that you go and pick that up and try to use it and so on, and it isn't like the manna was. Now the manna, they had a double portion of it on a Friday, and there wasn't any on Saturday. Now that this little shrub that grows out in the wilderness doesn't do that. And another thing, they could pick up a double portion on Friday to last over their Sabbath, Saturday, and it would keep fine. But they'd pick up some extra any other day and try to keep it overnight, and it turned bad and stank. Now, do people go over there and find that true, the tamarisk tree? Now, you see how some of our high critics and the like, trying to find fault of the Bible and take away all of its miracles and so on, they don't mention those things. They just give you their particular positive side of it and let it go at that. And, of course, if you're not a student of the Bible and you don't know what it says, why, you might swallow the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. And, of course, that's what they want. Well, beware, as Paul says to the Galatians, or to the Colossians. So he gave them bread from heaven for their hunger. Saved our lives during the wilderness. Now, it wasn't supposed to be angel food cake or something like that, although it is spoken of as angel food. It wasn't something like that. It was to sustain life. It wasn't like a fine restaurant meal, you know, with your smorgasbord or your salad bar and all that sort of thing. It wasn't that at all. It was something to save their lives while they were in the wilderness. Well, some of our forefathers lived practically on cornbread, too. And I suspect they appreciated it so much that they thought it was bread from heaven sometimes when they got real hungry. And brought us forth water for them out of the rock for their thirst. Brought water out of the rock for their thirst. And Paul speaks of that rock too, you know. That rock represented Christ. And water from the rock. Now you remember the dialogue between Christ and the Samaritan woman at the well of Sychar? And he said that he could give her living water, and she could never thirst. Now here you see is a type of it. They were given water out of the rock for their thirst, and promised them that they should go in to possess the land which thou had sworn to give them. Thou promised them that they should go in to possess the land which thou had sworn to give them. But did they? But they and our fathers dealt proudly, and hardened their necks, and hearkened not to thy commandments, and refused to obey. Neither were one mindful of thy wonders that thou didst among them, but hardened their necks, and in their rebellion appointed a captain to return to their bondage. Remember that happened at Kadesh Barnea? The spies went over, the 12 spies, and two of them said, oh yes, we can take the land, God will give it to us. A 10 of them, they just, all they could see was those great walled cities and those giants and so on. I said, we can't take that. We're just grasshoppers in their sight. Now God had commanded them to go into the land. He didn't ask them in the first place to stop and quarrel and bicker about the thing and so on, but to go into the land. And they didn't know. And it wasn't known until 38 years later that they could have easily gone into the land and taken it, because the people were actually licked then. You remember what the harlot at Jericho told the two spies that came into her house? She said that the people's hearts were like water. They were scared because the great God of heaven had done all those miracles, opened up the Red Sea, and performed all his miracles on Egypt with the plagues and so on. Why, they were ready to open up the gates and invite them in. And Israel didn't know it. A little lesson from that. We can get scared today of enemies that really don't exist. No, Paul said, we can be more than conquerors through Christ. He says, which strengtheneth me. That's his strength, you see. When Joshua went in and took the land a couple of years later, God did strengthen him. Well, they wanted to appoint a captain to return to their bondage. And you know what happened there? God told these people that because of their unbelief, that they would not enter the land. That generation would die in the wilderness. And so, out of 603,000, 550 men who were able to bear arms and left Egypt, there were two of them that entered the land, Caleb and Joshua, the two spies who were faithful and who said, we can take the land. Even Moses, because of unbelief, didn't enter the land. Now, that's hard for a lot of people to believe. But you read the account very carefully, and you'll find that God told Moses plainly that that's the reason. Took Moses up in the mountain, let him see the land. And Moses died up there, and we don't know who buried him, actually. It intimates that God buried him. Well, it's a good thing that they don't know, because Israel would have made that a place of worship if they'd have known where Moses was buried. They'd have made that an excuse for idolatry. Now, don't blame Israel too much for that. Are we any better? But he says here, but thou art a God, ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and forsookest them not. Now remember, it speaks here of their cry in Egypt, as we read up here several verses above. But when you read the account back in Exodus, you'll find that that cry was just a reminder to God. He didn't take them out of Egypt because of their cry. He took them out of Egypt because of the promise he made to Abraham. Let's not forget that. No, when Israel began to cry because of their bondage and so on, God heard it, reminded him, and the time was ripe. Now, Abraham was told very plainly, and the promise was made, just how long it would be until these people would be released from their bondage in a country which they were strangers. Didn't tell him it was Egypt. And when that day came, they were released. Now, why? Well, God told Abraham that the iniquity of the Amorite had not waxed ripe. In other words, these people, this false seed who lived in the land, and we named them here a while ago, the nations of them, were the false seed. Just like we had before the flood, a false seed. And God was letting their iniquity wax ripe. And when it did, and when the time came, Israel were to exterminate them root and branch. Because of the false seed. It wasn't just because they were other people like Israelites were, but they had Satan for their actual father through the demons. And another thing about these people, because of their origin and of their wickedness, they just had to be exterminated. Recent findings over there show that these people were so immoral that even children had social diseases. I've been digging up some of the graves and so on where these folks have been buried way back in those times. And when we realize their awful idolatries and all the immoralities and all that thing connected with it and so on, you can see that God was just in having these people eliminated so his people could have a little peace and quiet in this old world. Now, the false seed were eliminated at one time by the flood at Noah's time. And here is false seed being eliminated by the swords of Israel. And in the end times, about the time of the Great Tribulation, in the future, there'll be a false seed again, the seed of Satan. And they will be eliminated in a lake of fire. Not particularly maybe a literal lake of fire, but at least they'll be exterminated. That's a good Hebrew idiom for that. A little extermination program. And that seems to be about the last. About three interruptions altogether of false seed as far as history and prophecy is concerned. Verse 18. Yet when they had made them a molten calf, that is, they had cast it by melting the gold and made this form. Now, there had to be a form made to cast it, if it was a molten calf. Sometimes we think of it as being something that's cast and then carved, but it doesn't say anything here about a carving tool being used upon it to form it, but that it was cast. And I know when Moses spoke to Aaron about whence this came, Aaron says, why, the people gave me the gold, and we put it in a pot, and out came this calf. Doesn't that sound strangely like some of the philosophies we have today, evolution? Maybe Aaron was the first evolutionist, I don't know. Yea, when they had made them a molten calf and said, this is thy God that brought thee up out of the land of Egypt, and have brought great provocations. Why? Thinking of the great God who showed himself with his king of glory, the pillar of fire, the cloud, and all the great wonders he did and so on, and yet in a little period of 39 days, I forget all about it, and make this idol. Well, now, let's don't sit in judgment here too suddenly. First place, let's ask ourselves the question, well, suppose we had been in that crowd, what would we have done under those circumstances? Well, now, that crime brings us up a little short, doesn't it? And they had been in Egypt, subject to idolatry and all of that sort of thing for around 215 years, why, it would begin to have some effect. Just as people today have been, even Christendom has been subjected to all of these old traditions and so on, which deny a lot of the truths of the Bible. And a lot of those old traditions have become the constitutions, bylaws, and what have you, a lot of our church organizations. Things aren't any different today than they were back in those days, excepting that sin is dressed up nowadays, and it's much more, you know, popular and decent than it was then. That's about the main difference. Yet put thou in thy manifold mercies, forsookest them not in the wilderness. With all of their grumbling, they tempted God 10 times in the wilderness. He didn't forsake them. The pillar of the cloud departed not from them by day to lead them in the way, neither the pillar of fire by night to show them light, and the way wherein they should go. None of those things failed. Thou gavest also thy good spirit to instruct them, and withheldest not thy manna from their mouth, and gavest them water for their thirst. Why, and look back and see all of the wonderful blessings and so on like that, and yet at the time they were grumbling, and God was being merciful to them, good to them, and they didn't even know it and didn't appreciate it. And can we look back somewhat the same way in our lives and see that on some day we may have grumbled and blamed God for something, that he was very good to us, merciful and kind? Have we ever realized that? Yea, 40 years didst thou sustain them in the wilderness, so that they lack nothing. Their clothes wax not old. Why, wouldn't you hate to have to wear a suit of clothes or a dress for 40 years? And their feet swell not. Tells us another place that their shoes never wore out. All the time they're in the wilderness, 40 years. Well, I can wear shoes a long time, but not quite 40 years. Yea, 40 years didst thou sustain them in the wilderness, so that they lack nothing. Their clothes wax not old, and their feet swell not. Moreover, thou gavest them kingdoms and nations. Yes, after they went into the land of Canaan, they overcame kingdoms and nations, and didst divide them into corners, so that they possessed the land of Sihon, that's on the east side of the Jordan River, and the land of the king of Heshbon, and the land of Og, king of Bashan. Now, all three of those are on the east side of the Jordan. You can look at some of your old maps and find those. Og is probably the furthest north. And Og was a great giant. You know, he had a iron bedstead. And that was a long one. You'll have to look that up sometime. Their children also multiplied thou. Their children also multiplied thou as the stars of heaven, just as it was promised Abraham, and broughtest them into the land concerning which thou hadst promised to their fathers that they should go in to possess it. But think of all of the spankings and all of the things that God had to do with them in the wilderness and so on to finally get them there. But he did. So the children went in and possessed the land, and thou subduedest before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and gavest them into their hands with their kings and the people of the land, that they might do with them as they would. And they took strong cities and a fat land, and possessed houses full of all goods, wells digged, vineyards and olive yards, fruit trees in abundance. So they did eat and were filled, and became fat, and delighted themselves in thy great goodness. Now remember, it was spoken of as a land flowing of milk and honey. Now that's a figure of speech. It meant a land which had plenty. They could have all they wanted to eat and the very best of it. Now, they didn't have any rivers or streams flowing with milk or any of them flowing with honey. That isn't the idea. And let's watch these figures of speech. And remember, too, that they had to work that land to get that, too. You didn't produce milk without keeping the herds and feeding them and shepherding them on the hillsides and so on. And honey at that time was gotten from out among the rocks and so on where the bees put it, and that wasn't too easy either. Had to dig it out. If you want to take it literally. Nevertheless, after all of this, great goodness and so on, nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against thee and cast thy law behind their backs and slew thy prophets which testified against them to turn them to thee, and they wrought great provocations. Why? There's the other side of the picture. Therefore thou deliverest them into the hand of their enemies who vex them, and in the time of their trouble, when they cried unto thee, thou heardest them from heaven, and according to thy manifold mercies, thou gavest them saviors who saved them out of the hand of their enemies. Well, now, this is going over these things pretty rapidly here. If you go back and study the book of Judges, you will find that whenever they lapsed in idolatry and so on, that they were set upon by their enemies. And there were five captivities in the book of Judges, and then when they cried unto God, a judge would be raised up and relieved from that. Now, in all, there were 12 judges that God sent, and there was one who was a usurper. He was the 13th, Abimelech. Now, in these five captivities, we find an exact number of 93 years that they were really not God's people, Lahami, which is really a little warning, possibly, of what was to come later when they finally went into Babylonian captivity, and that lasted 70 years, all in one piece, whereas these others were in five pieces. And now, because of their disobedience and so on, they have been Lo-Ami, or not God's people, for about 1,915 years. Think of it. Well, now we'll have to stop here as our time is up for Nehemiah. So we begin the next time here with verse 28. All right, now for 1 Timothy. And we got down to the 4th chapter. I would like to take up a verse before, again, just briefly. Starting with the last few words of verse 15. The pillar and ground of the truth, and without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified in spirit, seen of angels, was preached unto the Gentiles, was believed on in the world, and was received up into glory. As I told you last week, you can take here as your subject the mystery of godliness and then put 6 items under that as they are listed here, and you can expand each one of those and make you a pretty good topic to write on or talk on. And I have suggested also that you can make a very brief outline of it, just a line outline. Just have a horizontal line with any length you want to make across your blackboard or whatever you're using. And at the left side of it, just have a little line with a fixed like an arrow pointing down. We'll put a point on it. And over to the right-hand side, another one just like that, excepting with the point pointing up. Now, that will show you there what this is about. The one on the left pointing down is when God was manifest in the flesh, came down from glory, and walked the earth here in likeness of sinful flesh, and did all of these things, and was received up into glory, and that's your last arrow pointing up. Up into the glory which he once had. That makes a nice little outline study. All right, chapter 4. Now the Spirit, that's the Holy Spirit himself, the one who speaks, the one who can be grieved, the one who has inspired writers to write the scriptures.